Rock.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is The Coming of the King of the Britons, Part 4. "The devil reigns in the material sphere," King Alfred the Great said, his voice booming across the galaxies. "And though all the saints and kings, bishops and warriors, sages and mystics of old, observe the catastrophe below, we can do nought if not one man rises up to our and his nation's cause and takes upon himself willingly the mantle of leader and raises the banner of our Lord against the tyranny. Many patriotic men are born, just as there are many birds in the sky, but alas, eagles are few. But when such a man, by the grace and mercy of our Father, is sent to lead his people, even as they face certain destruction, we in the heavens rejoice and rush to present that baby with special gifts and talents, while angels surround his cot. My message to you is be pleased, for in the midst of what appears to be all defeat, a leader of the Britons, as great as any who went before, but greater for these times, now walks among you. And he will be king of England, and his task will be as the task of Alfred, to unite the island as brothers, while restoring its kingdoms and sovereignties to independence within a federated union, to pay attention to the re-education of youth in matters of religion, history, and manners, that they be restored to their true identity and station as Britons, to stand as protector of the will of the people from any tyranny by the Parliament, by virtue of the royal prerogative. And this man is but a man, imperfect, as all men are, but he is schooled in right and wrong, and the gentlemanly sensibilities. He knows his weaknesses, and will be sustained by his conscience, the respect he has for his peers, and his love of his country, to which his life has been devoted. He bears no lust for power, nor any desire for adulation. Alone among all, he has surrendered to the call of his ancestors to take upon his wide shoulders the burdensome mantle of turning history's tide against the oppressor. A monarch whose sole interest is not in furthering a globalist future for a dynasty of cultural Marxist degenerates. A monarch who will not scheme with the regime to replace the indigenous people of the nation with foreigners, nor allow his offspring to engage in miscegenation with goblins or other racial strangers. A constitutional and not a political sovereign, a crown won by his own sword and his own love of the people and the lands of Britain, a servant and not a master of the tribes, and that crown bestowed upon his house only by the collective will of the warriors and a referendum by the masses. Wake up, Albion, and remember who you are, tribes of chieftains and kings, and of our own construction a parliament of all the people, and not the whim, at their cost, of merchants, moneylenders, and tyrants. And if you have any instinct to change the ancient disposition of our ways, ask yourself if you are not victim to the godless ideas and ideals of the Judeo-Masonic so-called Enlightenment and the Jewish revolutionary spirit, which has led directly to our plight. And this king, who is of noble enough but not of royal blood, will seek out a princess of an ancient family from one of the great western monarchies, and be she as fair as the early northern snows, or as ugly as a tree stump, or rich as Croesus, or poor as a pantry maid, yet be she of sufficient good character to win the king, who in this matter, knowing the need for the greatest perfection of this new start, will place the good of the nation before his own manly desires, selecting as his prime concern a mother who can raise good and royal children, whose household will reign within a formalized agreement, a written definition of moral character and standards of behavior, which will henceforth be demanded of the first family for the protection of the character of the nation. The princess who will be queen, rooted in an antique royal line, will receive the blessing of our ancients, of all our noble ancestors who gaze down from heaven upon the realm, and will bring forth a royal line, which, guided by this noble and nationalist king, and the constraints which will be set upon the behaviour and role of the monarchy, will ensure the continuance of the traditions of the realm, and the replacement of a traitorous nest, the bosom friend of all our worst enemies, whose youngest prince and his mother are goblins, whose people's princess was murdered by the very agency of which her husband, the heir, is patron, and whose younger household, beyond redemption, is rotten to the core. Remembering that this cabal, retired, a kind and thoughtful, nationalist and patriotic king, beloved of the people from his throne, even as he tried with all diplomacy to save the world and his subjects from a terrible war, exiling him to degradation abroad, while party to his defamation at home, replacing him with a traitorous 33rd degree Freemason, servant not of the people, but of the goblins. They may now retire themselves, perhaps to where their heart really belongs, not in the England we hope to save from them, whose alleged bigotry, racism and ethnocentrism they are so determined and anxious to fight, but to some new home among the people they love and cherish most dearly, nested within the vibrant, enriching diversity and pluralism of Pakistan, the Caribbean or Somalia. Our Scots, Irish and Welsh brothers are victims to a phony nationalism, which is nothing more than disguised third-worldist international communism, committed to their racial extinction. But the nationalist youth are now awakening to the fraud, and the whole of the genuine nationalist movement in the British Isles is united as one, placing all historical divisions behind them. A position increasingly held all across Europe, where one indigenous white folk faced the same threat of genocide. Make it clear to all men within our ranks that we are all brothers, be we pagan, Odinist or Christian, or of no faith at all. Let there be no infighting or disruption due to this matter, but may all be in harmony for the fight. Yet let it be accepted that Christians are the majority, both in our ranks and among the masses, and defer to that for this battle, as we did in the successful Crusades. Later on, as we repair the damage of the past, we can come together to find peace among all parties on this matter of faith and its role and effects on power, the maintenance of tradition and the state of the nation. When this war is over, and we have secured our land and a future for our white children, we can conclave together as mighty victors, pass goblets of wine between us, and agree on a political system for our sceptred isle. At the end of the war, let all the fighters, leaders and warriors, and such emissaries as the people wish to send, to come together in conference, and having heard all the supplicants and discussed their plans, may the will of the majority prevail, for matters of future law and governance of the realm. Britain now faces a coming civil war, as indeed do our entire white family in all our nations. But it will be a war as no other which has gone before, because our enemies, the spawn of Satan, who draw directly and most efficiently upon his power, are a race of cowards who never draw the sword in their own hands, but win only by deception and by fooling others to shed their blood for them. These are the angels of darkness, whom Jesus himself titled the masters of lies. There is no deed so shameful and offensive to God that they will not commit in their fight. They will burn the people of whole cities alive, and then convince all that it was they themselves who were the victims of those horribly tortured dead, so that the whole world will rise up with one voice to condemn those who were murdered at their hands. This is a war which will not be won by decent white European fighting men pitted against each other in honour and valour and fair play. This will be a war fought in the number of dimensions, material, psychological, moral and psychic, in which the enemy resides. This is a war in which the greatest of our Anglo-Saxon weapons, the cunning plan, must ever be deployed. This is a conflict in which we must match the aid of the devil to the enemy, to the aid of God, to our own men. For it is not enough that we have a leader, not enough that he can obtain at the requisite time an ever-growing standing army beneath him, but also must be sought and found a true Christian cleric bearing a light of brow, capable of returning our people back to the cross and thus launching a holy war. I say once more, to all you Britons, that your leader lives among you, but ye know him not. For at his birth, King Arthur came to his cot and presented him with a cloak of invisibility, so that in a time when visibility is a target for the tyrant, he should appear as ordinary to his peers, and only those with eyes to see and wisdom to comprehend may recognize him. Thus his safety before the time of strife is assured, in line with his own modesty and unassuming stature. He who claims not even to be first among equals remains deeply hidden in the midst of their self-importance. When Arthur went to grasp Excalibur, that sword, who knew him well for whom he was, leapt out of the rock into his hands, desperate for battle, as much as he was, and now united with his true master. And I tell you, he that grasps that invisible sword today, for Arthur hath made it unseen for these times, knows much of tactic and strategy, of the command of men, and the right traps to be set for the enemy, and all their weaknesses which can be scouted around, and all the keys to the doors of their minds, and many fine points of the art of war down the ages, fruit of the study and remembrance of a thousand battles, each joust like tin soldiers laid out on the fields of his military mind, knowledge that cannot be spoken of here, lest the enemy gain by it. When the hour cometh, he will raise his sword and cry, "For God, Britain, and England!" And he will lead you into battle, for he himself is English, though willing to die as readily for our brothers, the Welsh, Scots, Irish, and every European alike, being that the course of time and circumstance has now wedded all our disparate folk into one race and one tribe, In the face of the rise by overpopulation and migration of the Homo simians, the invasion of the Islamics, the colonizing settlements of the Gangean parasites, an invasive species as deadly as the rest, who, using the same business tactics as the goblin, conspire among themselves to pool their capital in order to buy up every small business in the land created by our people at a price higher than we can pay as individuals, and then use it as a base for an endless chain of interfamilial migration to import more of their own, and the invitation to all of these intruders into our lands by the goblins. Pebbles are many, but pearls are few, and know that this will be a war in which our force will be the smallest force, and so we must harness and deploy the energy and power of the other forces, even as our own battalions, setting them one against another through careful play. That battle should be waged in the form of a long series of pranks and infiltrations. No two things about war. First, the idea of its coming must be sown in the public mind by constantly referring in conversations and speeches, in songs and in writings to after the war this and after the war that and when the war comes, as though this is an event of absolute certainty and a given fact. To spread war, you must first spread rumours of war. When holding a nationalist event, hope that every speaker mentions it in some context, however so trite, in order that all that attend will repeat the notion themselves in their daily life, and the infection of the idea will spread. Find ways to casually repeat this every day. For example, in a shop, say, "When I get enough money, I must buy this item before the war, because it may not be available once it starts." The uninformed member of the public will then reply, "What war?" To which you casually reply, "Oh, the Civil War in Britain. Haven't you heard?" And then change the subject, leaving the idea sown firmly in his mind, a thought planted in his head, causing him to ever ask questions about the future. If he persists, say, "Well, I don't know anything about it myself, but I think I heard it was to do with race or some such. You'll probably hear about it on the news." People who phone in to radio programs, or take part in podcasts, or post in comment sections, or use social media, can spread this idea fastest of all. Repeat this term every day, and as many times as you can, to as many as you can reach. When the people hear this enough, and it spreads to more and more ears, it becomes common knowledge, and finally, it will be discussed in the media, who will have fallen into our trap if they do so, because they will be forced to defend the regime and the genocide of our people, while our people among the masses, disposed to gaining their nation back, will begin to grasp some confidence that such a proposition is being floated, and they will move to our side. Once this concept becomes firmly rooted in the public psyche, the natural expectation then arises in their minds that it is only a matter of time until the conflict begins. Thus, any violent event by the enemy, howsoever small, is no longer viewed as an isolated incident of crime, but yet another attack within a slowly growing and smouldering conflict, when any event, howsoever small, can be called an act of war, people will begin to rationally expect and one day demand a response. With this in mind, their whole attitude to the sustainability of the regime, along with their deference to its claims to power, subtly alters, what they previously envisioned as an infinite and unstoppable progression of the state, suddenly has a roadblock and a question mark firmly placed further down the line. Secondly, our entire future is based on circumstances. Being the smaller force, we cannot be the initial aggressor, quite the opposite, in fact. However, circumstance is a coin with two sides. One is waited for, and one is created, so we must not sit idly by and wait, but logically help to shape and create the direction we wish the river of circumstance to flow, and do so through non-violent actions and words. Know that while the goblin has all the power in the world to shut us down, he has, in order to secure our detriment, given license to his pets to say what we cannot say. So see to it that they use their victim status and their freedom of speech, which arises from it, to put the goblins to the greatest unease and peril by turning them against them, supporting aspects of any side which are to our advantage and to the disadvantage of any enemy group. Be friends of all and enemies of all as circumstances suit. Attend and take part in every major political demonstration by every side disguised as one of their own supporters, and by clever use of banner and poster, insert ideas or turn the direction to our advantage. Whenever the children of the barbarians attack the symbols of our tradition, or defame the Britons, ensure to fan the fires and incite them even more, to express greater hatreds, because such a campaign against our people and their ways is fertilizer to bring our own to our side. Do not be silent, but inflame them all the more. Never let any opportunity go to waste to use their energies against them, or to agitate responses to them. Should circumstances prevail in which a civil war arises between the Islamics and the people, then leave the people to war with the Islamics, while under cover of this altercation, deploy our ethno-nationalist warriors exclusively to the task of driving out the parasite tribes, the occupiers, and the smaller groups of invaders. Never do any work that you can manipulate your enemies, or the defensive regime, or the predictable press, or the ignorant masses to accomplish for you. This way of war we have learned from the goblin, and the goblin must be fought for what he is, a demon and a hostile spirit, by turning his own tactics and his youthful weakness as a slave of paranoia against him. One of the triggers for civil war will be automation, because with so many men laid off from work, tensions are more likely to arise, and ethnics will have more time to rape, rob, murder, deal drugs, and harass and terrorize our people. Automation robs a man of any chance to improve his lot in the world, and the government will seek to replace human wages with a fixed stipend. The tens of millions of brown people brought in to supposedly man the workforce and pay the pensions of the elderly will of a sudden have no value to the state, yet they will go on breeding. The cost of feeding and housing these legions of parasites cannot be offset except by taxing the robots. So soon the savings to the manufacturers will diminish, as government loves to tax and spend, and if the goblins keep on sending jobs to the Third World, the whole manufacturing and production base will collapse due to its unaffordability. Thus, as a result of this and other factors, the conditions for civil war will arise, the most potent of which would be the denial to the majority of the invaders of any part of the only thing they came to Britain for, their full weekly income from state benefits. It is doubtful that the long-dreamed-of and prayed-for financial crash will come. Money is like a religion. As long as people believe in the value of the pound, even if the usurers create it out of thin air, it will continue to have value. The recessions we have had so far have really amounted to harvesting by the bankers, who can blow up a big bubble of private debt and then burst it, grabbing the companies and land and property of the debtors, while they themselves become even more enriched, knowing that in the event that they have personally suffered losses, the government makes them up out of taxpayers' money. In the organised scam that is modern banking, the possibility of a total collapse, leaving the government and the bankers penniless, is just a fantasy. What is more likely to bring down the government's finance is the huge and ever-rising bill for its new dependents. For even now, while the tax-paying indigenous British people suffer austerity for themselves, it is business as usual for the elites and their imported pets. Should the government have to cut benefits, its first target will be the elderly and sick, and then the white man. The ethnics, whose interests our masters will always secure above those of the indigenous people, will always be the government's single most important priority. And these new British will continue to get full whack by any and every means until the system collapses, at which point these proxy terrorists against the British people will revolt even against the hand that feeds them. Should the government fail to feed the hordes of Africa in our inner cities, we will behold the sight of human cannibalism on our streets. The final battle may well be between ourselves and those of our own who have chosen to fight alongside ethnic minorities against the Muslims. This group will certainly be infiltrated and funded by the goblins, who will want to see that their place on the island remains secure, whatever the outcome after the uprising, and do so by means of backing as many sides as will suffer their support. The indigenous multiracialists, so engaged, who have not by that time seen sense, will have to fall with the enemy or survive to join us. Think for a moment what an enormous benefit repatriation will be to failed states like India or Kenya, where vast legions of the poor live in pipes, defecate in the streets, and wash in sewers at the sides of the road, while the rich pretend to be on par with first world countries. Third world hellholes, whom the racist goblins and Marxists have robbed of their doctors, nurses, professionals, shopkeepers and entrepreneurs, so that they cannot develop but remain a burden on our foreign aid. I say to the people of Britain, who are the best of men and women, and who have a conscience, and will always want to end injustice and right wrongs, please open up your hearts and have Christian pity and compassion for the tragic heartbreak suffered by the unfortunate and homesick millions of Sikhs, Hindus and others who have either had to flee from their beloved soil in search of a crust of bread at our table, or been criminally lured here by the lies of the goblins who promised they would feel fully at home and the country would be taken from the British people and handed over to them. Let every good British man and woman reach out to help these wretched exiles, these victims of a multicultural fraud, lonely for their huge extended families at home, thirsting for their own culture and hating ours, who could now journey back to their land with all the first world skills they have learned from the white man, skills to share with their people, if only we can help them take that first brave step of reverting to whence they came. An act of kindness, for which they will all thank us in the end, when, once resettled and happy on their own soil, with their own people, free from the white man, who they hold in contempt, and who they will never, ever integrate with, just as a cat cannot integrate with a bird. Even though the Christian and his ways are anathema to them, these intrepid wanderers will at least take back to countries like India the novel and liberating knowledge that a nation does not have to continue to suffer under traditional and cultural financial corruption and nepotism, but that there is a better way to create an efficiently run national infrastructure where basic services such as water, electricity and roads are functional. A way they have learned in Europe, the white man's way. There is no greater racism than this blatant theft under false pretenses of labour by the occupation regime, the only atonement for which is to send these stolen people away, for they can never be happy here, and we can never be happy with them here either.
You're listening to Real